Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Went to a wedding yesterday, Mark, which is not something I do very often. It's very exciting, isn't it? It's very nice wedding reception in Gospel Oak in North London. And the first thing the groom said to me excitedly was, we got a group, we got a band, and they're an ABBA tribute group. And I said,
fantastic.
Do you realize today is the 50th anniversary of ABBA, the advent of ABBA, when they won the Eurovision Song Contest in Brighton? You didn't know at all. But
perfect timing.
I do think it was absolutely extraordinary, you know, that if you tell people at a wedding reception in the 21st century that we've got an ABBA tribute group, they just think, well, great. It's the complete package, don't they? Because ABBA is, I can't think of anything that kind of has lasted as long as the idea of ABBA. You know what I mean? It's kind of bigger now than it's ever been at any point, hasn't it?
And now Universal Affection, not the case back in the day.
Possibly not.
It's interesting.
Not. Do you remember? April 6th.
April 6th, 1974. I remember it really vividly.
Did you watch it at the time?
No, I didn't watch it. No, because I was far too
cool,
long-haired and bedenimed. And
you were
far too involved in the Atlanta rhythm section or something to have watched it. But I was very aware of it, you know. And do you remember we talked to Carl Magnus Palm?
Yep.
About 2 years ago for a podcast, who's the kind of Mark Lewison of ABBA.
He's the Mark Lewison of ABBA world, yes.
Yeah, and he's written these fantastic books about them. And so I was remembering that conversation we had and the things he told us. Because the key thing was that they were very big. I mean, they were individual superstars in Sweden, weren't they? You know, the Hep Stars and the Hootenannies and the two girls have both been solo stars. But they hadn't, and they were big in Sweden. They weren't enormous, but his whole thing, the campaign was to break out of Sweden and become international stars. And they put all this effort into the Eurovision, didn't they? Do you remember they tried to get in the year before in 1973 with a song called Ring Ring?
Oh, yes.
And they really worked it out. They said, we're going to have a three-syllable title and it's going to be internationally understandable. And they came up with the original song was called Honey Pie. And they thought, well, we can't do that because there's a Beatles song called Honey Pie. And then they came up with Waterloo. Waterloo, the battle place, the battlefield in Belgium, that will work and everyone will understand it. We're going to do the song in English, so it's got, you know, massive appeal. And the things he told us, I remember one was that, about their stage clothes, which he said that in Sweden at that time, there was a sort of tax dispensation, wasn't there, on stage clothes to encourage people to produce kind of theatrical costumes, to encourage the world of theatre, really. So therefore, you were given unlimited funds to develop stage wear as long as it couldn't be used in everyday use, because otherwise you'd just be getting the state to pay for your clothes. So you had to come up with stage wear that could not be worn off stage, which is why they came up with those extraordinary things. Do you remember Agnetha's wearing the blue satin knickerbockers with the skull cap and the silver boots? Do you remember that? And the boys are wearing their kind of Regency ruffs. You know, it's all beads and preposterous boots. And, I was just looking at a little clip last night, and David Vine is the sponsor.
David Vine.
This is pre-Terry Wogan.
It is really. It's quite interesting. It's pre-kind of... It's pre-camp, isn't it, really? You know,
yeah.
It's just very straight BBC presentation, isn't it? And well, it's not strictly BBC, I suppose. It's probably done by the Euro broadcaster or whatever. I don't know. What strikes me is it's quite clunky TV presentation, isn't it? It's Katie Boyle doing the...
Katie Boyle, yeah.
She is the MC. And as you say, David Vine introduces them as the ABBA group. As if he's not used to the idea of a group just being called ABBA, you know, as simple as that.
Bjorn is introduced as Bourne.
And then they come on, and it's as if there's been no proper camera rehearsal, because the camera just entirely focuses on the two girls.
Yeah.
And you don't see the two guys until later on in the performance. And there's all sorts of things which don't really make any sense to me. The introduction of the musical director, which was then a tradition of the way Eurovision was done. Comes on dressed as Napoleon.
Yeah.
So everybody has their kind of, their conductor who comes over. And you think, who's he conducting, for goodness sake? This is, it's a pop group, and I don't know if they're...
Everything's pre-recorded apart from the girl's vocal.
I
don't even think the male vocal is live. It's just the two girls singing. Thing that's live. But David Vine, I just forgot, there's a bit where they come on, he says, like, if the judges were men, judges were men, this lot would get a lot of votes, and you'll see why in a moment.
In a moment.
Fantastic.
And you're expecting them to come on in these kind of, barely dressed at all, but actually they're very modestly attired. It's before the arrival of the kind of sex bomb in popular music, isn't it, Rick?
Yeah.
It's obviously before the arrival of video and so forth. It's also, and I was just looking at this, the perfect time for ABBA to arrive, because, by God, popular music was at a pretty low ebb. If you look at the UK charts...
Oh, it's appalling.
...in the week.
It's mud.
I'm going to read you the top 10.
Yeah, go on.
I'm going to read you the top 10 from the week that... that ABBA did Waterloo on the Eurovision Song Contest. Number 10, Seven Seas of Rye by Queen. Then The Most Beautiful Girl in the World by Charlie Rich. The Cat Crept In by Mud.
Yeah.
You Are Everything by Diana Ross and Marvin Gaye. Hot Chocolate, Emma by Hot Chocolate. Angel Face by The Glitter Band. Every Day by Slade. Remember Me This Way by Gary Glitter. Billy Don't Be a Hero by Pabeliz. Yeah. And, of course... resident at the top of the charts at the time, Seasons in the Sun by Terry Jacks. It's pretty uninspiring.
Shocking stuff. But also, we're recording this on the Sunday and they're showing the whole programme tonight on the BBC. There's a nice piece by Alexis Petridis in The Guardian yesterday talking about the rest of the acts, and he says that the rest of the acts are terrible because they are a real throwback. It's all cabaret and it's so actually their song and the way they looked and the way they arranged it, everything about them really stood out. It really did look like it was kind of forward-leaning,
And I suppose you play that record 50 years later and it still sounds fantastic. Yeah. Still sounds the way it did at the time. Whereas if you played anything else, from that contest, it wouldn't stand up in the same way.
No, Olivia Newton-John, was it Long Live Love, was it? Was our entry? I can't remember.
Joint fourth.
Interesting part fact, Britain gave them no points. They didn't. I don't think they actually gave them no points, but you're only allowed to vote for 10 acts, and they voted for 10 acts, not including Sweden. So that's interesting. But one thing I'd forgotten, and that Carl Magnus Palm reminded us of, was that at the time, you thought that was the big breakthrough, and it was. They had an international hit. But firstly, Sweden turned against them. Do you remember that? There's an interview with them directly after the show. And the Swedish reporter says to Stig, the manager and co-writer of the song, actually, and Frida, he says, last year you made a song about people phoning each other, which was Ring Ring, and this year you did a song about how 40,000 people died. It's really kind of like woke attitude to the whole thing. And they were absolutely furious. And the same thing happened in Britain, because, in fact, there was huge coverage. And everyone was going on about, you know, the two married couples. It was all just impossibly fabulous. And Bjorn and Agnetha had just had a baby, and there was something incredibly wholesome about them. And there was Sweden, and it was dairy product and all that. But actually, the press thought they were immense. The music press ignored them completely. The music press, well, which is an irony, because actually the music press were tied up with Sweet and Mud and the Glitter Band, as we were saying. But the mainstream press kind of generally gave the impression that they were preposterously naff. And you forget that, you know, that when it happened, everyone thinks, oh, ABBA, it was all wonderful and we loved them straight away. No, we didn't. For 18 months, the UK did not buy into their follow-up singles. And they talked in the book that we were talking about how they come back on tour each time. And it started off in Rolls-Royces and then it was Daimler's. And then they were pretty much down to Ford Cortinas and terrible little hotels. It was going really badly. And it wasn't until SOS that they actually had another hit and came back. And from that point, and then Dancing Queen in 1976, and it kind of took off. And the other thing I didn't know was the revival. The revival, though, for 10 years, nothing really happened. No one talked about ABBA at all. They were just generally considered to be cheesy and something we ought to forget and are a bit embarrassed about. And then there was a club, I think, called the Bar Industrial in Hanover Square. And Boy George and George Michael and Erasure and various people used to DJ, and they used to play ABBA songs every night. And that encouraged the record company to put out ABBA Gold in 1992. And then it all, from that point, it all took off. And now we're in a position where we can't remember that anyone had anything but a good word to say about
and now, it. And now it's absolutely standard at weddings in the 21st century, you know, where the most of the people at the wedding, I couldn't help thinking of this as the ABBA tribute group, you know, piped up. You know, most of the people at the wedding are like 35 to 40 or something.
Yeah.
Like, and we're not born, but, you know,
born don't 10 even years remember, after Waterloo.
Don't even remember the first revival or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just absolutely astonishing. And I've just been looking at the Sunday Times, the front page of the Sunday Times, from the day after ABBA's triumph in April 1974. And the amazing thing is, they're a tiny little news item on the bottom of the bottom left. But one of the big news stories is 14 incendiary bombs had gone off in shops in the London area, largely in the London area, you know, Wembley and Welling Garden City and Edmonton and so forth. And I'm not sure anybody knows to this day who, you know, there were no injuries, but 14 incendiaries is absolutely, it's classic. That's 70s nostalgia for you, isn't it? You know, that was the reality of everyday life at the time. Now, the other thing I wanted to recall on that particular day, something that took place, you know, in a different country, might as well have been a different universe.
On
the same day, was the California Jam.
Yeah.
Took place at Ontario Speedway. It was a racetrack out in the Californian desert. And ABC Television paid for the promotion of a major rock festival. It decided they wanted a big rock festival. And so they started off, they signed Earth, Wind and Fire, I think. They signed Seals and Crofts.
And they signed
the Eagles.
Black Oak, Arkansas.
But then it built up from that. And obviously somebody thought, we've got to get some big hitters in here to really sell tickets, to get kids to trek out into the broiling heat of the desert on a Saturday. And so we're going to get three of those big limey acts. And so they got Black Sabbath, they got Deep Purple, and they got Emerson, Lake and Palmer. you know. Now,
all that, huge at the time. I mean, fantastic. The right
does, to sign. Doesn't that make your heart sing, Mark, at the idea that you're going to watch Black Sabbath, followed by Deep Purple, followed by Emerson, Lake and Palmer. Black Sabbath had to go on in the afternoon. And there's something about Black Sabbath. Black Sabbath in the daylight just doesn't seem right.
Doesn't work.
Doesn't work at all. And then they were due to be followed by Deep Purple, who had the new members. David Coverdale had just joined as a singer to replace Ian Gillan, I suppose. Richard Blackmore decided that they weren't going to go on until, or he'd been promised, they weren't going to go on until the evening, until the dusk. And so he locked
the lights. That's the old kind of Led Zeppelin at Bath Festival.
Absolutely.
Because you're going to look fantastic when the lights are on you.
He locked himself in his trailer and refused to come out, you know. So there's poor sods out in the desert in the broiling heat.
Weren't they an hour late or something?
They're at least an hour late. And so they went on.
And also, were there any screens? Because I looked at some of this footage.
No.
That's the thing that struck me, though. 250,000
350,000.
Sorry, 350,000.
They're ranking 350,000.
350,000 people. And it's just, you look at it, and it's the most colossal crowd. They're miles away. They say it's the loudest amplification system ever used.
Whoopee. Sure
it have to be. But the point is, there are no screens. And therefore, what on earth? And also, you know, Black Sabbath, I mean, much as we love them, but that is slow, cumbersome music, isn't it? Which is not going to engage you if you're 3/4 mile away. I don't know how anyone could have been entertained by it, but they were. Go on anyway.
And then Emerson, Lake and Palmer went on, you know. And at this point, people must have just been thinking, I want to get home to my bed, or where's my car, or whatever.
Yeah.
But Emerson, Lake and Palmer didn't know. You don't have an abbreviated version of Emerson, Lake and Palmer, do you? You either have the full serving, or you have nothing at all. And therefore,
finishes with Keith Emerson on his grand piano revolving in midair, isn't he? Playing it upside down.
Apparently revolving in midair. Well, he is definitely revolving in midair, but he's not playing because it was an empty piano. It was a stunt piano, obviously. Yeah. But there is the poor soul being twirled around, you know, in a way that it is kind of a cruel and unusual punishment that people who want to go into outer space are put through, isn't it, to acclimatize them.
Forgetting that there's only the first 150 feet, you can actually see what's going on anyway. It's absurd. And there's the Ritchie Blackmore guitar thing, which is amazing. Ritchie Blackmore decides to smash his guitar up. And in a very kind of, again, ponderous way, goes to the back of the stage and dutifully carries odd bits of amplification equipment to the edge of the stage and lobs it over into the pit, doesn't he? And then eventually throws the guitar into the crowd, which is absolutely astonishing. Imagine doing that today. Imagine throwing a guitar into the crowd. What kind of legal action you'd face?
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's the most... It's the most appalling spectacle in the entire history of rock and roll, actually, is the California Jam. And if you haven't seen it, of course, it's out there on YouTube. And, you know, go and fill your boots. And one little footnote, which will enhance your viewing, is that David Coverdale, who was a singer and just had just joined Deep Purple, was reputedly doing the whole set while in his back pocket having a check for $1 million.
That's right.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
It's 60 years ago this month since the release of the first Rolling Stones record, which, as you know, has long been a favourite of mine. If people are not aware of this is the one with... it's all rhythm and blues covers, really. It's Muddy Waters and Jimmy Reed and Slim Harpo and Rufus Thomas and so forth, all knocked together in a demo studio in Denmark Street, just off Charing Cross Road, in about three sessions, I think, something like that. They always used to say it was such a basic studio, it actually had egg boxes on the wall as insulation. Mm. You know, it was hardly state of the art. It was just a place that people used to make demos for publishers. But Andrew Oldham did a deal with Decca Records where it was an independent deal, really. So they didn't have to use the Decca Studios. They could go and do it in this place. And by some miracle, I don't know how it happened, you know, the results are just magical to me. You know, it's got a sound that nothing else has. And even when the Rolling Stones kind of went back there, do their second album, it wasn't as good. That first album just has an absolutely extraordinary sound to it. It's always been a favorite of mine. It was always the one that could get any party started in the 1960s. Yep. You know? After the game of Spin the Bottle, they would be frantic dancing and pairing off to the sound of Walking the Dog or Mona or whatever. Do you know what's just struck me for the first time this week? And I'm looking at the cover now, because this was, you know, the cover was a huge statement in itself, in that it didn't say the Rolling Stones on it. It didn't say didn't have a name of an album. It actually has a picture of the Rolling Stones standing side on in shadow, and then it has the Decca logo in the top right. But the amazing thing is, because they look like relative ruffians as compared to the kind of the smiling face of the Beatles or Jerry and the Pacemakers or whatever. And you looked at them, you thought, wow, they're a motley crew. But it's only when I look at it closely now, after 60 years, Mark, I realize something I've been missing for all of these 60 years. And this is it. 4 out of 5 of the Rolling Stones on the cover of that epoch-making first album are wearing shirts and ties. Shirts and...
Probably under a great deal of duress, actually.
I don't know. Probably not. You see, so Brian's wearing them. Keith, Bill, Charlie, the only one who's gone so far as to have an open-neck shirt is Mick Jagger. And, you know, we forget just how revolutionary was the fact that they weren't actually wearing a band uniform.
That's the thing that struck me about it. Because the thing about the Beatles is that, I mean, obviously they wore uniforms on stage, didn't they? I mean, right the way through, they all wore matching suits or whatever. But if you look at those album covers, everything about those Beatles pictures suggests a kind of a democracy and a kind of unity, doesn't it?
Uniformity.
It's kind of like one uniformity. Just 4 people together. You've got to see as one person. You've got the Roll Necks, the Hard Day's Night, Black and Whites, the sturdy winter wear on Help. Rubber Soul, that picture, they look like they're the same person.
Yeah.
Drawn together. You've got the drawings on Revolver and on the back, they're all wearing exactly the same shades. You've obviously got the Sgt. Pepper suits, you've got the Magical Mystery Tour uniform as well. And even kind of Abbey Road, they're kind of wearing suits, aren't they?
They are, yeah.
And so there's that sense that you always were invited to see the Beatles as a group, as 4 people together. Whereas the Stones, that also is so revolutionary that the Stones dressed differently in itself, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
They just went on, they wore different coloured gloves, different trousers, different types of shirts.
That used to make the business of looking at any photograph of the Rolling Stones absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
If you go back and look at those, you know, those early pictures taken by Gareth Mankiewicz, who we talked to on the podcast about this, you know, just looking at the detail of their shoes or their belts or their waistcoats or whatever, you look at it and think, God, I've never thought of having anything like that or wearing anything like that. You know, they were a walking fashion statement, the Rolling Stones were. 5 walking fashion statements. It's a way we've got used to kind of, I suppose, indie bands dressing like that ever since, haven't we, really? You know, there's no expectation that if you see Coldplay that they'll be wearing a uniform. You'd expect them to be wearing...
Blur's the best example.
They'd be wearing their own choices, wouldn't they, really?
Yeah. You know,
that would be part of the messaging around them. Although, the other interesting thing, thinking about bands in the 60s, so, you know, bands of musicians always wore uniforms. Classical musicians wore uniforms. Jazz musicians wore uniforms. Pop groups did it. And that continued for most of them through the 60s until the timing all changes. And it changes really radically. And you can see this so clearly if you go back and look at old music papers, or you can look back at old album covers from 1967. Suddenly, everybody is wearing fancy dress. Just sort of faintly, that's what they've done. After the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper, the Rolling Stones do it with their satanic majesties. Absolutely everybody else. You look at Procol Harum, I don't know.
Yeah.
You look at the...
Jethro Tull.
You look at anybody. It's fancy dress, yeah. You know what I mean? Somebody will be wearing a kind of a strange kind of Chinese mustache or something, you know. It's as if they really have raided the dressing up box of a down-at-heel theatrical repertory company somewhere in the provinces of England, you know, and all decided to dress like that with no exceptions. You know what I mean? You don't see one holdout member of Procol Harum or Family or I don't know who's still wearing their old stuff. No.
No, it's all or nothing. Absolutely.
It's absolutely
not to be the concept.
Everybody is in fancy dress for a period of about 2 years. It's absolutely astonishing thing in itself. So there's the Stones' first album 60 years ago. Still sounds absolutely extraordinary. And do you know why? The thing that we often forget, it's all hits. It's not their hits, but it's all hits. It's Muddy Waters hits. It's Jimmy Reed hits. Slim Harpo hits.
It's the best possible combination because it's songs you already know and like, done by a band whose version of things you adore. So you're getting a Stonesization of all these things that you really loved anyway.
There it is.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
There's a good story about the Roald Dahl estate hiring a load of famous people off the telly to come up with news stories featuring Roald Dahl characters. I mean, that's happened with James Bond. People have rewritten James Bond books, you know. And we were talking about this earlier and saying that there's a possibility that somebody might do this one day with Beatles characters. You know, because there's Lovely Rita, isn't there? And there's, you know, there's you could do the Further Adventures of Mean Mr. Mustard. I can see that. I can see that working, you know, possibly as a cartoon book for kids. The continuing story of Desmond and Molly Jones and their Barrow in the Marketplace.
Bungalow Bill.
Bungalow Bill. It makes Eleanor Rigby, Father McKenzie, Rose and Valerie and the Reconstitution.
Screaming from the Gallery.
It's good, isn't it? Vera, Chuck and Dave.
These are characters.
These are characters you could bring in. You could write a series of country hits about a character called Rocky Raccoon. Contemporary, a very contemporary one, I think, is Sweet Loretta Martin, who thought she was a woman, but she was another man. That's a theme that could be developed. And then there's Polythene Pam and Sexy Sadie and Michelle and various others. Why isn't it being done, Dave?
Well, I did. Well, because they're still with us, I suppose. But, you know, we're rolled down, shuffled off this mortal coil. But there's still companies who own those copyrights and are looking to, you know, to extend their commercial life. And one of the ways they do this is just, here's a new thing featuring an old familiar property.
Yeah.
And the way they've done it with the Roald Dahl estate is they've gone to a load of people who are known off the telly, who suddenly apparently have the magical ability to invent fictional stories. Isn't that wonderful, Mark?
Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that
off the top of their heads?
Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, you know, it will remain the case that the future will be in the past. And we were also talking about the fact, wasn't it? It's all anniversaries, isn't it? Is it 30 years since Kurt Cobain died?
It is, isn't it? Yeah, almost exactly to the day, I think. Yeah.
Good grief. And isn't that also, isn't the demise of Kurt Cobain pretty much the start of Britpop? Is that the case?
Well, that would be, I think that's fair to say that was that kind of brought down the, rung down the curtain on grunge, didn't it?
Right.
But we were talking to Neil Tennant last week, our old pal from the Pet Shop Boys, who was on the smash hit staff in the early 80s, and we've just done a recording with him, which is going out next week, actually. And he made a really good point, I think, about how the 80s was the last great era of forward-looking pop music. And he said that the 90s, meaning really Britpop, was when everything started to look back, and it was then going back to the Beatles and going back to the Stones and the Kinks and going back to the great sort of era of 60s pop and kind of rebooting it. I thought that was a good point, actually. And grunge, I suppose, to some extent, was the final, you know, that was chucked out of the park, wasn't it, by the arrival of Oasis and Blur. And that, in a sense, was at least moving forward and looking into some kind of future.
Yeah, it's funny because that was my main memory of Britpop, was I thought to myself, I remember thinking this at the time, this is the first movement in popular music I've ever been aware of where the prime movers seem to be saying, it's all already been done.
Yeah.
They seem to be saying, we do what we can, but it's not quite as good as what we liked 20 years earlier. I never got the feeling that anybody in pop music had ever come forward like that, like they did. That was the feeling I got about
it. I can remember some analyst at the time saying that for pop music to get a hit, a certain percentage, it was like sort of 70% of the song, must somehow feel familiar. And if you applied that to Oasis, it's no surprise those things were hits because they were so familiar, because they were all chord sequences that you had heard before. You might not be able to instantly recognise them, but there were things there. They're all part of your DNA.
It's interesting. It's fascinating. Because also, doesn't this also kind of go back to what we were saying earlier about ABBA, that, you know, the ABBA revival, I think, was triggered by, and I haven't got the dates in front of me, Erasure did an ABBA revival, didn't they?
Well, medley. They were part of that club that I was talking about, Industrial. Yeah.
And they
used to go on once a week and just do ABBA songs in a really camped up way, and it just became hugely popular.
But they had a hit with an ABBA tune, didn't
they?
Yeah,
they did.
And then round about the same time, you get the arrival of Bjorn Again, who are the Australian ABBA tribute group,
yeah,
who become enormously successful. And it does all tie into the idea, doesn't it, that by the early 90s there was a general feeling, oh, let's start again kind of thing. You know, you could go back 20 years and people would have forgotten, but it would at the same time feel familiar to them. And that's the world we've been living in ever since, isn't it?
And there's something also about periods of music that were so kind of apparently universally reviled coming back that makes it even sweeter when they're kind of reappraised. Because as I was saying earlier, you know, ABBA were just, it was so cheesy and so...
Yeah, I don't know if it's quite as simple as that. Yeah, I was watching that BBC thing that they ran about, you know, Britain's kind of affair with ABBA, which is interesting, you know, because the British clearly have taken ABBA to their hearts in a way that not everywhere in the world would have done. And Stuart McKenzie's on there, you know, Stuart saying, well, Europop was a bit of an insult as a term in those days. Although it's very interesting, when you watch those documentaries, they're all the same. You just take all the bits of chat you had with people and you cut the bits into tiny, tiny segments and you put them all at the beginning to try and build your argument, you know what I mean? Because I can remember, was it The Visitors? I'm very bad at the chronology of ABBA records. But I can remember Bob Woffenden, who at the time was the reviews editor of The Enemy, the lead review on The Enemy when The Visitors came out, I think it was The Visitors, was a full page Bob, you know, singing the praises of ABBA. So there would be people who would think they're very cheesy and Europop. But at the same time, there were also people who thought, had a rather chin-stroking, you know, attitude.
Only towards the end. See, ABBA, The Visitors were right at the very end, wasn't it?
Oh, okay. Well,
earlier
wasn't,
on, no, I think that
this wasn't The Visitors. Okay, it wasn't The Visitors. If you go back, there is, and I was there, it must have been 76 or whatever, there was a full-page review of an ABBA album in The Enemy, and I think it was written by Bob Woffenden, which was very, very respectful of ABBA.
But you can't deny that in the early 70s, around the time of Waterloo, there was a sort of, it was a kind of snobbishness, really, that the British thought that they it was their imperial phase was still going on. We kind of invented pop music in the early 60s, still coasting on the back of the Beatles and everything like that. And there's a very dim view that no other European country could do it right. You would not take a German pop hit or a French pop hit or a Swedish pop hit or a you know, Belgian pop hit seriously, don't you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, but you know, ABBA, they went to number one in that chart. They knocked Terry Jacks' Season in the Sun off the top of the charts.
Not before time.
Yeah, the Paper Lace were no more. You know, once that happened, you know.
Yeah.
But it's extraordinary, you know. Ever since then, it's been ABBA's world, and we just live in it.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink, and it's like being in the pub.
And we're joined by not one, but two birthday guests. We've got effectively a birthday party this week. We're joined by Al. Say hello, Al.
Hello, Al. How are you?
And say hello, Stephen.
Hello, Stephen.
And you two chaps actually know each other, don't you?
Yeah, it's an amazing coincidence.
Go on, explain. Stephen, explain.
Oh, okay, so Al is in a band called Abel Gance, and they are a sort of progressive rock band. Sorry for saying sort of, Al, but you know what I mean.
we are an outlier in the progressive.
Yeah, you're an outlier, and I run a couple of festivals a year called the Winter's End and Summer's End festivals in Chepstow. And this time last year, Abel Gance were playing that festival.
All right.
Okay. On this day, was it actually on this day?
No, it was actually on my birthday. It was April 1st last year.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you've got one coming up soon, haven't you, Stephen?
Yes, it's next weekend in Chepstow. All ticket types still available.
Right. And who's the headliners?
We've got Oliver Wakeman and his band playing, actually.
Oh, okay. The Son of Rick.
Son of Rick, who was also in Yes for a while himself. His new band are playing. It's a kind of one-off appearance. They're rehearsing specially for it. We've got a band called The Fierce and the Dead. And I've completely forgotten who else is playing.
So tickets still available.
Winters-end.co.uk.
All right, okay.
Thank you.
Zorp are playing it as well. They played our festival.
Yeah,
they played our Prague Before Christmas last year.
Everybody's got a festival, Mark, don't you think? You're really missing out here.
Is this an excuse to dig out very, very cultish old Prague T-shirts then? Presumably there's some quite interesting gear being there.
We do see a few. Obviously, we do a T-shirt each year. Twice a year. So we see a lot of our own T-shirts.
Oh, that's nice.
Going back next year, the Summer's End Festival will be the 20th in 2025.
Wow. Amazing. Well, God, that's extraordinary. Well done.
You're writing a book about a Yes album, isn't that right?
Sorry?
You're writing a book about a Yes album, 90125?
I am, yeah. In fact, that's my topic for discussion.
Yes, go on.
Specifically, but a topic that comes from the production of that album. Yeah, in fact, I've got it. That's the album. And I did a piece for Prog Magazine about 90125 at the end of last year, and that sparked off more research and more discussion. It's a very interesting album, though it's not one of those albums that people think of when they think of the sort of great Yes albums, because it's from the 80s. But the way it was pulled together is very contrived. It was pulled together in lots and lots of different stages, including John Anderson coming back into the band right at the last minute and fiddling around with the album and making it a lot better, to be honest. So my subject for today was other albums that are very contrived but still turned out really good in the end.
I've got a really good nomination for this, actually.
Okay,
I've got it here. And it actually has a Yes connection, which I only realised after I'd chosen it. And that is Simon and Garfunkel's Bookends. And their Yes connection is they have, this is where they did America.
Of course.
Which used to feature as part of their stage act, did this fantastic kind of stretched out version of America. Anyway, Bookends, I was just reading about this, was recorded over a period of about 2 years and the huge amounts of mucking about. And when CBS signed Simon and Garfunkel, they made the mistake of saying that they would cover all recording costs because they thought, folk duo, how much money can that cost?
Yeah.
Because Simon and Garfunkel think, well, great, we're going to get string quartets here, we're going to get all our mates in or whatever. It ended up costing a fortune. And they did it over a long period of 2 years. It's got all kinds of strange things. It's got recordings of elderly people in old people's homes, all kinds of stuff. But it hangs together for three reasons. And do you know what those three reasons are? One is America on side one, which is one of the greatest Simon and Garfunkel songs. The other is Mrs. Robinson on side two. And the third thing is that cover picture taken by Richard Avedon. It just became, you know, kind of the iconic photograph of Simon and Garfunkel. So that's my nomination of a record that was a mess as they made it. And in many ways still is a mess, but is held together by, you know, a couple of songs, which I suppose is the case with the Yes album, isn't it? If you have one huge song, you know, it ends up justifying absolutely everything else.
Yes, well, obviously that was identified by Trevor Horn, obviously who produced it very early on as being the hit, though Trevor Rabin, the guitarist, says, well, he always thought that was going to be a hit.
How Trevor Horn heard that. It was on a demo tape or something, wasn't it? And it was just still running, and he heard it play in the studio and thought, that is something we can work on. And that the rest was persuading.
It was at a listening session in Los Angeles, and the whole band were actually listening to Yes tracks, and Trevor Horn was going through all these kind of very like 80s-sounding rock songs and thinking, oh, that they're not great.
Yeah.
And then he stumbled across this song. Trevor Rabin, actually, who I've spoken to about this, actually disagrees slightly with that interpretation. So it's all...
They always do.
People are just reinterpreting the same situation, I'm totally sure.
It's absolutely the case, because people always think in any situation, we're always talking, Mark and I were talking about it the other day, you always think you're the active participant.
Yeah.
And what you don't realize is you're the passive participant at the same time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What happens is a consequence of the actions of loads of people. And you never manage to work out exactly how it might be.
So, Al, you've got you're in a Kate Bush tribute act, is that right?
Yes, yes. I mean, I've been following this band Cloudbusting for many years on social media, and last year they put a thing out that they were looking for a keyboard player. You know, I live in Scotland, and they're all based down south. So I sent a wee email off that basically said, I love her music, I love the music since I was 14. I know the songs inside out, I don't know the notes, but, you know, if you want to give me a shout, give me a shout. And by the way, I'm not a twat. So I sent all that off, and I, obviously the last part's a subjective thing.
Right.
They came back, I got an audition, and I'm now one of the keyboard players. You know, they've got a guy called Matt Bowers who does most of the work, and I do the gigs he can't cover.
And they're based in England, are they?
Kind of all over the place in the south of England. So, I mean, my next gig with them is on the 11th in Weymouth, then we're in Wolverhampton on the 12th of April. And then we're in Torquay on the 13th, and I'm picking up some gigs next month as well. It's a very lonely place being the keyboard player in the Kate Bush tribute band because, you know, you are very exposed. There's absolutely no safety net in a lot of these songs. It's just piano and voice.
Yeah.
But the sort of log I wanted to throw in the fire is obviously when I got this gig, I started doing my due diligence and looking through all the... Yeah, looking through all the sort of old interviews and stuff like that. And lo and behold, who pops up on some of the old interviews? But two rather cherubic-looking young men
who
bear more than a passing resemblance to you two.
Well, we interviewed her. I think it might have been about, 1982 or something. I think we were in
The Dreaming album.
And all I can remember she was promoting a tour, and she didn't particularly want to do it. And they made a deal with her. They said that we will hire the guard's van of the train, especially for you, and you can then rehearse your dance routine.
She was doing a video.
She was doing a video shoot, that's right. And that, I think, was the hook. And we only had about 2.5 minutes with her, and it was quite difficult, wasn't it? A live television interview, wasn't it? I can't imagine we got much out of her, apart from the fact that this is what Kate Bush sounds and looks like, and here she is talking, which was a rare thing in itself. Can you remember any great revelations?
I can't particularly. Isn't that the record that's got Rolf Harris on it?
Yeah. Yeah.
It is. Didgeridoo.
Summarily excised from the record back in, I think, 2018. You know,
oh, was it really?
She got her son to cover it. She got her son to do all the parts.
Oh, really?
It was re-recorded.
Yeah.
This is quite interesting, actually. As a friend of Mark's and myself called Lucas Hare, and Lucas doesn't believe in streaming services for anything, either film or music, because he says basically over a long period of time, everything gets re-edited. You know what I mean? To suit the turn of the people who are in charge of these things. And I suppose that's a kind of case of, that's very much case in point. Now, Kate Bush, I'd completely forgotten about this for years and years and years. And then I had the odd experience that I have occasionally. Somebody drops me an email saying, I've just been watching an interview you did with so-and-so. And I always go, I never met them in my life. No recollection whatsoever. And then they send me the link and you go, oh, crikey, yes, that is me, you know. And of course, what I don't think anybody would have predicted back then, 82 or whatever Mark says is over 40 years ago, was just that her star would rise all over again over a really long period of time, which is, you know, certainly seems to be the case now.
See, I think she's a queen of prog. I think Kate Bush is a prog rock artist, fundamentally. She's a book definition of prog. I mean, she started out with two songs about ghosts, effectively.
Yeah.
You know, and she's not afraid to use different voices. She's not afraid to use literary references. She's just not afraid to be her. She is the queen of prog.
Well, I once interviewed her brother, John Carter Bush, and he had a book of photographs out about her, and I thought your point's very true, because the book, you've probably seen it, it's amazing. Yeah. It's just these pictures of them growing up. It was at East Wickham Farm.
Yes.
And from the age of five, she seems to be permanently in fancy dress. she's permanently spinning around some garden somewhere with a lute or some early kind of fairly primitive kind of, you know, keyboard instrument, and living in this complete kind of prog Tolkienian fantasy. It's just wonderful, really. And you realise she was always like that, you know, and it all just took off when she was 15, 16.
So there you go. She's the original prog artist, and sometimes great albums come out of at a very confused circumstances, as in the case of Yes and Simon and Garfunkel. And you can no doubt supply your others if you've got them. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Happy birthday, whenever it is, whenever it was, and many more of them.
Many more. See you next year.
Everybody, say goodbye. It's the end of the podcast. Say goodbye, Al.
Goodbye, Al.
Goodbye, Stephen.
Bye, Stephen.
It's the Waltons, yes, isn't it? Yes. Good night, John Boy.
Say good night, John.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.